see what happens.
How did you become interested in Haverford?
Well, my memories are indistinct, but I know that I had limited choices because I think the idea was that I wanted to stay close to home because there were limited finances, even though my father had a good job. I didn't want to go to a large school. I learned something about Haverford College and its fine academic record back in the early 30s. And I knew, not well, I knew an older Norristonian, this is where from whence I came, and I went to Norristown High. I knew a fellow named Bill Daub, who was about the class, I think, of 33 or 34. And Bill lived in my street, as it turned out. And so I went down one day and knocked on his door and said, tell me something about Haverford College. In his own quiet, almost introspective sort of way, he told me what he thought about it. He thought well of it. And so I was encouraged at least to look more into it. I went to look at the place, and I finally ended up by seeking admission there. And I'm not digressing. We had entrance exams at that time, and we had them in May, as I recall. This would be May of 32, and I took them at the designated place. I think it was Haverford College, as a matter of fact. And I failed miserably. I really did. I mean, I recall that my average, we'll say there were three different subjects. I think matters. My average was a grand 45. So obviously, I had to do something if I was going to be serious about trying to get into Haverford. So when I, at the recommendation of then Dean Brown, I was tutored that summer, and I was tutored by a fellow whose name I think was Haynes, but I'm not Haynes, I'm not sure, but he was a class in maybe the mid-20s at Haverford, an academician. I think he taught at a public school, Roxborough High or something like that, but he lived in Roxborough, and I went down daily. The summer of 1932, and it was a dismal summer, I went down daily by bus from Norristown down to Roxburgh to see my tutor. You want me to go on? So at the end of the summer, I went back to Haverford College, and I took the boards again. I think it was called boards at that time.
Oh, boy.
Was it that? Took him at time, and I believe it was actually in Roberts Hall, and this was then this would be early September of 1932, and of course the football team was then out practicing on Walton Field or its environs, and I remember this, the last exam I took was the afternoon. We'll say of September 6th, I'm not sure, but it was a late afternoon, and just finished my exam, handed it into the official, I don't know who it was, and I immediately, almost immediately, I got a tap on the shoulder from a fellow named H. Tatlow Brown, who was then, as it turned out, was the director of, not director of athletics, but the physical education, who said he'd like to take me out to football field to be introduced to a fellow named Gygas, who was the head football coach. Well, of course, I had no idea that I'd passed my three exams, but I never heard anything more. So I was in at Haverford as far as, and I don't think that was the fastest admission. I thought it was astonishing because unless Tat himself was a
of course, he was also dean of the college, so he had power.
Of course, that's true. That's right. So that's how I got that's how I came to be admitted to Harvard. And I was, it was a glorious day, and it was a glorious 4 years.
Did you practice that afternoon?
I got suited up that afternoon. Now the reason that I was a Midland, as far as talent is concerned, a football player. I was about 6 feet, a little over 6 feet tall. I was 170 pounds, something like that. But in those days, that was relatively sizable. And the thing was that I managed to get through playing football in high school and in junior high and parochial school. I played a little bit there before and remain upright. I didn't get hurt. And anybody at those days at Haverford, and this is probably true for a long time thereafter, that managed, that had a modicum of ability and remain uninjured, was making a sizable contribution. He was filling a hole in some hole in the place. Mine happened to be right end. And so, when I was telling you earlier about looking through this scrap that my sister had prepared without my knowledge for all those years I went to Harvard College and also to Norristown High, in that first year, at Haverford, I became known as the Iron Man, because I played all the games. I think we only played 7 games. And I played all the games, a full 60 minutes. There was no defense and no offense and defense. Then there was, and I played and every minute until the last 2 minutes of the final game, which I was removed. That gave me the title of Iron Man, which is the best I ever earned, I think, in the football field.
What do you remember about Gygas?
I think Gygas had, and you can tell better about this, I had a suspicion that he had a little Indian background. Did that make sense?
I don't know.
He was a swarthy man. He was monosyllabic. He was knowledgeable. He had come from, in fact, he was still coaching, I think at that time, Frankfurt High, and a number of the Frankfurt team, like a fellow named Charles Kahn and some others that went to Frankfurt, ended up at Haverford. Now, perhaps Elwood Gygas was responsible. I think he had a couple of his associates who came from the same place, named Frankfurt High. I don't know how knowledgeable he was about the sport itself. I assume he was just as good as anybody else at that level at that time. But a somber, quiet, soft-spoken, nice man.
He was just there as football coach?
He was just there as football coach, and it was that's right. So was that his particular assignment? He didn't partake in any other way, I don't think, in Haverford College affairs.
Yeah.
He didn't coach anything else, I don't believe.
He distinguished himself later, after he left Haverford.
Oh, yes, he did. He became superintendent of schools at Norristown. And made a very fine record there, and was well-liked, well-respected, because I know some teachers at the Norristown High School, in the Norristown High School system, that spoke very highly of him, so that I shouldn't say that the... it's my recollection, he was just a very nice, moderate man. He wasn't a bullying type, and he was proficient. He was proficient.
Harvey Harmon had been there before.
Oh, I remember. Yes, I remember.
And so Haverford had some distinguished people.
Yes, they did.
Now, somewhere along the way, Roy Randall came.
Roy Randall came, yeah.
And you played a part of this.
Well, we had a committee, I believe, and I was on that committee. Were responsible for choosing somebody, I'm not quite sure, but we were given the impression by the administration. administration that we were, our thoughts were, I mean, our feelings were being considered, and so that we had to, we met on a regular basis, met with some of these, applicants, and I remember sitting particularly with Roy Randall, who was then, I think, from Virginia somewhere.
I think so.
He?
I think
something
so.
Like that. And he came up, and we were over in the fourth entry, and Bill Harmon and Bill Tiernan had a suite there, and we sat there and interviewed Randall, and we gave the nod of approval to Roy, and by golly, the next day he was appointed. And so I think it was and I look at the pictures that I saw from my scrapbook, look at the pictures of Roy Randall, my God, he was not much older than ourselves, but I thought he was an antiquity. Mm. He was in his 30s, I imagine.
Well, he was the first full-time.
He was the first full-time football coach, I believe, yes.
And then also
Coach Harmon, as you say, was a part-time, as was Elwood Geigers. So that I never thought of it at the time as being, you know, the decisive a matter, full-time football, mm-hmm. I mean football coach, excuse me, because he also taught, as you well know, he taught basketball and baseball, mm-hmm. and I managed to get on those squads, so I was exposed to a good bit of Roy and his sweet wife, Dell, mm-hmm. both of whom were gone, as a matter of fact.
Were they married when he came?
They were married, yes, they were, yeah. And as a matter of fact, it was, while I was still there, Dell had the name of the son.
Mark,
that's right. He was born right at those apartments right there as you enter Haverford from Lancaster Avenue there. First one on the
Marion.
Left. Marion. Not Marion, no, it's on the left-hand side.
Oh.
That's where they were living, and that's where Mark was born. I imagine it'd been about 1935,
mm-hmm.
the night that he was born, something like that, 34 or 35. I never knew Mark, did you?
Yes, I did.
I never knew him well.
He was maybe about 6 years old when I came as a freshman.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And then he was there as a student when I came back to work in the admissions office in 1957.
Right.
He's a fine athlete.
Oh, yes, he was. That's true, yeah.
He had a physical handicap of a breathing problem.
Oh, that's right.
Which limited him, but he was a fine athlete.
I remember when that happened, that was shortly after he was born, his first year, we'll say.
Something like that.
Yeah, that he had something caught in his throat.
Mm.
I think a nut or something like that.
Uh-huh.
It was lodged in his throat, and they had to had to operate upon him to dislodge it, and he never regained full control of his voice.
Well, did you play three sports in your freshman year then?
Well, I think all told at Haverford College, and I had about, I think I gained about 9 letters, something like that. So I was football for 4 years, I was basketball for about 3, and I think it was baseball too. And then baseball too. And I played little junior varsity tennis my first 2 years.
And you ran the student council.
Right, I ran the student council.
How long did you serve on student council?
Well, I don't know, frankly, Bill, about that. I think in some capacity for most of my 4 years. Mm-hmm. President of students, is that the Students Association?
Students Association.
Yeah.
Changed by my time.
Is that right? Yeah.
And became Student Council.
Student Council, that's the Students Association. I know that.
Were there any issues that you particularly remember when you were part of that?
I wish I could say that, we certainly never I can't think of anything that was the, like drinking on campus.
From reading the news, it sounded as if a favorite springtime sport was breaking windows with snowballs.
Oh, yeah.
Does that register with you at all?
Yes, well, there was a fellow that was a class or two ahead of us named Singer. And his name was Bugger. And his nickname was Bugger Singer. And that's one of the things that he did. I don't know whether he ended up in the clergy or not, but he was a rip-snorting sort of a guy, and he created a lot of havoc, we thought, at that time. Wherefore the name Bugger. And I think Bugger Singer and some of his cohorts did some damage on campus of innocent type. Mm. Nothing more than a broken window. I don't think we weren't dangerous in those days. We didn't take ourselves that seriously, I guess.
Well, again, I'm basing my knowledge on the news, which is dangerous, as you well know. But the news carried a number of stories about snowball breaking of windows, including one about a young man who was thrown out of college, broke windows, I guess, right in front of Tat Brown. Tat threw him out of college and went on. Within an hour, according to the news, he was on his way back to his home. And the students protested this and had a long session with Tat and convinced Tat that he should reinstate the man.
Who was this man?
I think his name was Wadlington.
Wadlington. No, well,
that doesn't ring any
bell. That doesn't ring a bell to me, no.
I thought it was a significant time because the student argument was that you didn't give us a chance to take our responsibility on this, we would have dealt with it. You acted first.
Yeah. I like to think that I was in the chair.
This was
at
in
that
1934.
Time,
that
wouldn't have been me now.
That in the news says that when you were president of the Student Association, that you announced a policy that women should not be in the dormitories after midnight.
No.
And I think probably that was the first time hours were established for women on campus.
You mean they were there surreptitiously before that?
No, they were there. Nobody defined a policy.
Yeah.
Again, according to the news, a couple of years before, the students had asked for a policy, and the administration said no. Finally, some freshman asked a senior president student council what she should do, and the president student association said, "Well, you should act in an honorable way." Everybody knows what that is.
You're not putting words in my mouth.
No, that wasn't true.
Not mine.
No, that was before you.
Before
that was before
me.
You. But apparently, there was a push to have some kind of guidelines established, and I think that council that you were on was the first one to establish a guideline of an hour.
I do recall that we did have. Did have certain times were expanded times when there was something going on, the junior prom, senior prom, something like that. The women were allowed to stay a little later.
By my time, it was called a festive occasion.
Oh, really? Was that it? Really? Was it properly defined?
The council defined every year what a festive occasion was.
Were they flexible as they went along?
But I always thought it was amusing that up until the 1930s, there were no time limits and no rules, apparently, about entertaining women guests on campus.
And yet, I'm not sure. I don't think we abused whatever privilege we had with women. And I think whether we just were not, we're too wet behind the ears to know any better.
Well, times were different, too.
Times were different. Of course they were, yeah. Yeah.